Chapter 48 Earth Measurers. Follow these instructions carefully. Draw two parallel straight lines vertically down a sheet of paper, about 7 inches long and a bit under 3 inches apart. Draw a third line, also vertical, also parallel, and of equal length, exactly midway between the first two. Write the letter S for south at the top end of your diagram, the end farthest away from you, and the letter N for north at the bottom end. Add the letters E for east and W for west in their appropriate positions at either side of the diagram, to your left for east and to your right for west. What you are looking at are the outlines of a geometrical map of Egypt, incorporating a perspective very different from our own, where north is always equated with up. This map, where up is south, seems to have been worked out an enormously long time ago by cartographers with a scientific understanding of the shape and size of our planet. To complete the map, you should now mark a dot on the central of the three parallel lines, about 1 inch to the south of, up from, the northern end of the diagram. Then draw two more lines diagonally down from this point, respectively to the northeast and northwest, until they reach the northern ends of the two outermost parallel lines. Finally, link those parallel lines directly with horizontal lines running east to west at the northern and southern ends of the diagram. The shape produced is a meridional rectangle, oriented north-south. This rectangle is 7 inches long by just under 3 inches wide and has a triangle demarcated at its northern, lower end. The triangle represents the Nile Delta, and the dot at the apex of the triangle represents the apex of the delta, a point on the ground at 30 degrees 06 minutes north and 31 degrees 14 minutes east, very close to the location of the Great Pyramid. Geodetic marker. Whatever else it may be, it has long been understood by mathematicians and geographers that the Great Pyramid serves the function of a geodetic marker, geodetics being the branch of science concerned with determining the exact position of geographical points and the shape and size of the Earth. This realization first dawned in the late 18th century when the armies of revolutionary France, led by Napoleon Bonaparte, invaded Egypt. Bonaparte, who had cultivated a deep interest in the enigmas of the pyramids, brought with him a large number of scholars, 175 in all, including several greybeards gathered from various universities who were reputed to have acquired a profound knowledge of Egyptian antiquities, and more usefully, a group of mathematicians, cartographers, and surveyors. One of the tasks the savants were set, after the conquest was completed, was to draw up detailed maps of Egypt. In the process of doing this, they discovered that the Great Pyramid was perfectly aligned to true north, and of course to the south, east, and west as well, as we saw in Part 6. This meant that the mysterious structure made an excellent reference and triangulation point, and a decision was therefore taken to use the meridian passing through its apex as the baseline for all other measurements and orientations. The team then proceeded to produce the first accurate maps of Egypt drawn up in the modern age. When they had finished, they were intrigued to note that the Great Pyramid's meridian sliced the Nile Delta region into two equal halves. They also found that if the diagonals running from the pyramid's apex to its northeastern and northwestern corners were extended, forming lines on the map running northeast and northwest until they reached the Mediterranean, the triangle thus formed would neatly encapsulate the entire delta area. Let us now return to our map, which also incorporates a triangle representing the delta. Its other main components are the three parallel meridians. The eastern meridian is at a longitude 32 degrees 38 minutes east, the official eastern border of ancient Egypt from the beginning of dynastic times. The western meridian is at a longitude of 29 degrees 50 minutes east, the official western border of ancient Egypt. The central meridian is at longitude 31 degrees 14 minutes east, exactly midway between the other two, 1 degree 24 minutes away from each. What we now have is a representation of a strip on the surface of planet Earth that is exactly 2 degrees 48 minutes wide. How long is this strip? Ancient Egypt's official northern and southern borders, which bore no more relationship to settlement patterns than the official eastern and western boundaries, are marked by the horizontal lines at the top and bottom of the map and are located respectively at 31 degrees 06 minutes north and 24 degrees 06 minutes north. The northern border, 31 degrees 06 minutes north, joins the two outer ends of the estuary of the Nile. The southern border, 24 degrees 06 minutes north, marks the precise latitude of the island of Elephantina at Aswan, where an important astronomical and solar observatory was located throughout known Egyptian history. It seems that this archaic land, sacred since time began, the creation and habitation of the gods, was originally conceived of as a geometric construct, exactly 7 terrestrial degrees in length. Within this construct, the Great Pyramid appears to have been carefully sited as a geodetic marker for the apex of the delta. The latter is located at the junction of 30 degrees 06 minutes north and 31 degrees 14 minutes east, a point in the middle of the Nile at the northern edge of modern Cairo. Meanwhile, the pyramid stands at latitude 30 degrees north, corrected for atmospheric refraction, and at longitude 31 degrees 09 minutes east, an error of just a few minutes of terrestrial arc to the south and west. This error, however, does not appear to have resulted from sloppiness or inaccuracy on the part of the pyramid builders. On the contrary, a close look at the topography of the area suggests that the explanation should be sought in the need to find a site suitable for all the astronomical observations that had to be taken for accurate setting out and with a sufficiently stable geological structure on which to park, forever, a 6-million-ton monument almost 500 feet high with a footprint of over 13 acres. The Giza Plateau fits the bill on all counts. Close to the apex of the delta, elevated above the valley of the Nile, and equipped with an excellent foundation of solid limestone bedrock. Doing things by degrees. We were driving north from Luxor to Giza in the back of Mohammed Walili's Peugeot 504, a journey of just over 4 degrees of longitude, that is, from 25 degrees 42 minutes north to the 30th parallel. Between Asyut and Almania, a corridor of conflict in recent months between Islamic extremists and Egyptian government forces, we were provided with an armed escort of soldiers, one of whom wore plain clothes and sat in the passenger seat beside Mohammed, fondling an automatic pistol. The others, about a dozen men armed with AK-47 assault rifles, were distributed equally between two pickup trucks, which sandwiched us front and rear. "Dangerous people live here," Mohammed had confided out of the corner of his mouth when we'd been stopped at a roadblock in Asyut and ordered to wait for our escort. Now, although obviously rattled at being obliged to match the high speed of the escorting vehicles, he seemed to relish the kudos of being part of an impressive convoy, lights flashing and sirens wailing, weaving in and out of the slower traffic on the main highway from Upper to Lower Egypt. I looked out of the car window for a while, at the unchanging spectacle of the Nile, at its fertile green banks and the red haze of the deserts a few miles away to east and west. This was Egypt, the real, organic Egypt of today and yesterday, which overlapped but spread out far beyond the strange official Egypt of the map described, a rectangular fiction, exactly 7 terrestrial degrees in length. In the 19th century, the renowned Egyptologist Ludwig Borchardt expressed what is still the conventional wisdom of his colleagues when he remarked, "One must absolutely exclude the possibility that the ancients may have measured by degrees." This was a judgment that seemed increasingly unlikely to be tenable. Whoever they may have been, it was obvious that the original planners and architects of the Giza necropolis had belonged to a civilization which knew the earth to be a sphere, knew its dimensions almost as well as we do ourselves, and had divided it into 360 degrees, just as we do today. The proof of this lay in the creation of a symbolic official country exactly 7 terrestrial degrees in length, and in the admirably geodetic location and orientation to the cardinal points of the Great Pyramid. Equally persuasive was the fact already touched on in chapter 23 that the perimeter of the pyramid's base stood in the relationship 2 pi to its height, and that the entire monument seemed to have been designed to serve as a map projection on a scale of 1 to 43,200 of the northern hemisphere of our planet. The Great Pyramid was a projection on 4 triangular surfaces. The apex represented the pole, and the perimeter represented the equator. This is the reason why the perimeter is in relation 2 pi to the height. The pyramid-earth ratio. We have demonstrated the use of pi in the pyramid, and need not go into this matter again. Besides, the existence of the pi relationship, though interpreted as accidental by Orthodox scholars, is not contested by them. But are we seriously supposed to accept that the monument could also be a representation of the northern hemisphere of the Earth, projected on flat surfaces at a scale of 1 to 43,200? Let's remind ourselves of the figures. According to the best modern estimates, based on satellite observations, the equatorial circumference of the Earth is 24,902.45 miles, and its polar radius is 3,949.921 miles. The perimeter of the Great Pyramid's base is 3,023.16 feet, and its height is 481.3949 feet. Scaling down, as it turns out, is not absolutely exact, but it is very near. Moreover, when we remember the bulge at the Earth's equator, our planet being an oblate spheroid rather than a perfect sphere, the results achieved by the pyramid builders seem even closer to 1 to 43,200. How close? If we take the Earth's equatorial circumference, 24,902.45 miles, and scale it down, divide it by 43,200, we get a result of 0.5764 of a mile. There are 5,280 feet in a mile. The next step, therefore, is to multiply 0.5764 by 5,280, which produces a figure of 3,043.39 feet. The Earth's equatorial circumference, scaled down 43,200 times, is therefore 3,043.39 feet. By comparison, as we've seen, the perimeter of the Great Pyramid's base is 3,023.16 feet. This represents an error of only 20 feet, or about 0.75%. Given the razor-sharp accuracy of the pyramid builders, however, who normally worked to even finer tolerances, the error is less likely to have resulted from mistakes in the construction of the giant monument than in an underestimation of our planet's true circumference by just 163 miles, probably caused in part by failure to take account of the equatorial bulge. Let us now consider the Earth's polar radius of 3,949.921 miles. If we scale it down 43,200 times, we get 0.0914 of a mile, 482.59 feet. The Earth's polar radius, scaled down 43,200 times, is therefore 482.59 feet. By comparison, the Great Pyramid's height is 481.3949 feet, just a foot less than the ideal figure, an error of barely 0.0015%. As near as makes no difference, therefore, the perimeter of the Great Pyramid's base is indeed 1 to 43,200 of the equatorial circumference of the Earth. And as near as makes no difference, the height of the Great Pyramid above that base is indeed 1 to 43,200 of the polar radius of the Earth. In other words, during all the centuries of darkness experienced by Western civilization, when knowledge of our planet's dimensions was lost to us, all we ever needed to do to rediscover that knowledge was to measure the height and base perimeter of the Great Pyramid and multiply by 43,200. How likely is this to be an accident? The common sense answer is not very likely at all, since it should be obvious to any reasonable person that what we are looking at could only be the result of a deliberate and carefully calculated planning decision. Common sense, however, has never been a faculty held in high esteem by Egyptologists, and it is therefore necessary to ask whether there is anything else in the data which might confirm that the ratio of 1 to 43,200 is a purposeful expression of intelligence and knowledge rather than some numerical fluke. The ratio itself seems to provide that confirmation for the simple reason that 43,200 is not a random number, like, say, 45,000 or 47,000 or 50,500 or 38,800. On the contrary, it is one of a series of numbers and multiples of those numbers which relate to the phenomenon of precession of the equinoxes and which have become embedded in archaic myths all around the world. The basic numerals of the pyramid-earth ratio crop up again and again in those myths, sometimes directly as 43,200, sometimes as 432, as 4,320, as 432,000, as 4,320,000, and so on. What we appear to be confronted by are two remarkable propositions, back to back, as though designed to reinforce one another. It is surely remarkable enough that the Great Pyramid should be able to function as an accurate scale model of the northern hemisphere of planet Earth. But it is even more remarkable that the scale involved should incorporate numbers relating precisely to one of the key planetary mechanisms of the Earth. This is the fixed and apparently eternal precession of its axis of rotation around the pole of the ecliptic, a phenomenon which causes the vernal point to migrate around the band of the zodiac at the rate of 1 degree every 72 years and 30 degrees, one complete zodiacal constellation every 2,160 years, precession through two zodiacal constellations or 60 degrees along the ecliptic takes 4,320 years. The constant repetition of these precessional numbers in ancient myths could perhaps be a coincidence, viewed in isolation. The appearance of the precessional number 43,200 in the pyramid-earth ratio might also be a coincidence, although the odds against this must be astronomical. But when we find precessional numbers in both these very different media, the ancient myths and the ancient monuments, it really does strain credulity to suppose that coincidence is all that is involved here. Moreover, just as the Teutonic myth of Valhalla's walls leads us to the precessional number of 432,000 by inviting us to calculate the warriors who go to war with the wolf, 500 plus 40 multiplied by 800, as we heard in chapter 33, so the Great Pyramid leads us to the precessional number of 43,200 by demonstrating through the pi relationship that it might be a scale model of part of the Earth, and then by inviting us to calculate that scale. Matching fingerprints. At El Minya, our escort vehicles left us, though the plain-clothed soldier in the front seat stayed with us until Cairo. We paused for a late lunch of bread and falafel in a boisterous, noisy village, then motored north again. Throughout all of this, my thoughts remained focused on the Great Pyramid. Obviously, it was not an accident that so immense and conspicuous a structure should occupy a key geographic and geodetic location in a part of the world that appeared bizarrely to have been conceived of and geometrized as a rectangular symbolic construct, exactly 7 terrestrial degrees in length. But it was the pyramid's other function as a three-dimensional map projection of the northern hemisphere that particularly interested me, because it suggested a match with the ancient but advanced maps of the world described in Part 1. Those maps, which made use of spherical trigonometry and a range of sophisticated projections, had been claimed by Professor Charles Hapgood to provide tangible documentary evidence that an advanced civilization with a comprehensive knowledge of the globe must have flourished during the last ice age. Now here was the Great Pyramid, proving to have a cartographic function vis-à-vis the northern hemisphere, and also incorporating a sophisticated projection. As one expert explained, each flat face of the pyramid was designed to represent one curved quarter of the northern hemisphere, or spherical quadrant of 90 degrees. To project a spherical quadrant onto a flat triangle correctly, the arc or base of the quadrant must be the same length as the base of the triangle, and both must have the same height. This happens to be the case only with the cross-section or meridian bisection of the Great Pyramid, whose slope angle gives the pi relation between height and base. Was it possible that surviving copies and compilations of ancient maps, like the Piri Reis map, for example, might in some cases go back to source documents produced by the same culture that skillfully incorporated its knowledge of the globe into the dimensions of the Great Pyramid, and indeed into the carefully geometrized dimensions of ancient Egypt itself? I could hardly forget that Charles Hapgood and his team had spent months trying to work out where the original projection of the Piri Reis map had been centered. The answer they finally obtained was that Egypt, and specifically Aswan in Upper Egypt, where, as we've seen, an important astronomical observatory was situated at latitude 24 degrees 06 minutes north, the official southern border. Needless to say, precise astronomical observations would have been essential for calculations of the circumference of the Earth and of latitude positions. But for how long, before the historical period, had the ancient Egyptians and their ancestors been making such observations? And had they indeed learned this skill, as they stated forthrightly in their traditions, from the gods who had once walked among them? Navigators in the boat of millions of years. The god believed by the ancient Egyptians to have taught the principles of astronomy to their ancestors was Thoth, he who reckons in heaven, the counter of the stars, the enumerator of the earth and of what is therein, and the measurer of the earth. Normally depicted as a man wearing an ibis mask, Thoth was a leading member of the elite company of first-time deities who dominated religious life in ancient Egypt from the beginning to the end of its civilization. These were the great gods, the Neteru. Although they were believed in one sense to be self-created, it was also openly acknowledged and understood that they had a special connection of some kind with another land, a fabulous and far-off country referred to in the ancient texts as Ta-Neteru, the land of the gods. Ta-Neteru was thought to have had a definite earthly location, a very long way south of ancient Egypt, seas and oceans away, farther even than the spice country of Punt, which probably lay along East Africa's Somali coast. To confuse matters, however, Punt was also spoken of sometimes as the divine land, or God's land, and was the source of the sweet-smelling frankincense and myrrh, especially favoured by the gods. Another mythical paradise was also linked to the Neteru, an abode of the blessed, where the best of humans were sometimes taken, which was believed to be situated away beyond a large expanse of water. As Wallace Budge observed in his important study Osiris and the Egyptian Resurrection, the Egyptians believed that this land could only be reached by means of a boat or by the personal help of the gods, who were thought to transport their favorites thither. Those lucky enough to gain entry would find themselves in a magical garden consisting of islands, interconnected by canals, filled with running water which caused them to be always green and fertile. On the islands in this garden, the wheat grew to a height of 5 cubits, the ears being 2 cubits long, and the stalks 3, and the barley grew to a height of 7 cubits, the ears being 3 cubits long, and the stalks 4. Was it from a land such as this, superbly irrigated and scientifically farmed, that the agriculture bringer Osiris, whose title was President of the Land of the South, had voyaged to Egypt at the dawn of the first time? And was it from a land such as this, accessible only by boat, that ibis-masked Thoth had also made his way, crossing seas and oceans to deliver the priceless gifts of astronomy and earth measurement to the primitive inhabitants of the prehistoric Nile Valley? Whatever the truth behind the tradition, Thoth was remembered and revered by the ancient Egyptians as the inventor of mathematics, astronomy, and engineering. It was his will and power, according to Wallace Budge, that were believed to keep the forces of heaven and earth in equilibrium. It was his great skill in celestial mathematics, which made proper use of the laws upon which the foundation and maintenance of the universe rested. Thoth was also credited with teaching the ancestral Egyptians the skills of geometry and land surveying, medicine and botany. He was believed to have been the inventor of figures, of the letters of the alphabet, and of the arts of reading and writing. He was the great lord of magic, who could move objects with the power of his voice, the author of every work on every branch of knowledge, both human and divine. It was to the teachings of Thoth, which they guarded jealously in their temples and claimed to have handed down from generation to generation in the form of 42 books of instruction, that the ancient Egyptians ascribed their world-renowned wisdom and knowledge of the skies. This knowledge was spoken of almost in awe by the classical commentators who visited Egypt from the 5th century BC onwards. Herodotus, the earliest of these travellers, noted the Egyptians were the first to discover the solar year and to portion out its course into 12 parts. It was the observation of the course of the stars which led them to adopt this division. Plato, 4th century BC, reported that the Egyptians had observed the stars for 10,000 years. And later in the 1st century BC, Diodorus Siculus left this more detailed account. The positions and arrangements of the stars, as well as their motions, have always been the subject of careful observation among the Egyptians. From ancient times to this day, they have preserved the records concerning each of these stars over an incredible number of years. Why should the ancient Egyptians have cultivated an almost obsessional interest in the long-term observation of the stars, and why, in particular, should they have kept records of their movements over an incredible number of years? Such detailed observations would not have been necessary if their only interest, as a number of scholars have seriously suggested, had been agricultural, the need to predict the seasons, which any country-born person can do. There must have been some other purpose. Moreover, how did the ancient Egyptians get started on astronomy in the first place? It is not an obvious hobby for a valley-dwelling, landlocked people to develop on their own initiative. Perhaps we should take more seriously the explanation they themselves offer, that their ancestors were taught the study of the stars by a god. We might also pay closer attention to the many unmistakably maritime references in the pyramid texts. And there could be important new inferences to draw from ancient Egyptian religious art, in which the gods are shown travelling in beautiful, high-prowed, streamlined boats built to the same advanced ocean-going specifications as the pyramid boats at Giza and the mysterious fleet moored in the desert sands at Abydos. Landlocked people do not, as a rule, become astronomers. Seafaring people do. Is it not possible that the maritime iconography of the ancient Egyptians, the design of their ships, and also their splendid obsession with observing the stars, could have been part of an inheritance passed on to their ancestors by an unidentified seafaring, navigating race in remote prehistory? It is really only such an archaic race, such a forgotten maritime civilization that could have left its fingerprints behind in the form of maps, which accurately depict the world as it looked before the end of the last ice age. It is really only such a civilization, steering its course by the stars for 10,000 years, that could have observed and accurately timed the phenomenon of equinoctial precession with the exactitude attested in the ancient myths. And although hypothetical, it is only such a civilization that could have measured the earth with sufficient precision to have arrived at the dimensions scaled down in the Great Pyramid. The signature of a distant date. It was almost midnight by the time we reached Giza. We checked into the Siag, a hotel with an excellent pyramid view, and sat out on our balcony as the three stars of Orion's belt tracked slowly across the southern heavens. It was the disposition of these three stars, as archaeoastronomer Robert Boval had recently demonstrated, that served as the celestial template for the site plan of the three Giza pyramids. This in itself was a remarkable discovery, suggesting a far higher level of observational astronomy and of surveying and setting out skills than scholars had attributed to the ancient Egyptians. Even more remarkable, however, and the reason that I had arranged to meet him at Giza the next morning, was Bovall's contention that the pattern traced out on the ground, in almost 15 million tons of perfectly dressed stone, matched exactly the pattern in the sky during the epoch of 10,450 BC. If Bovall was correct, the pyramids had been devised using the changes precession effects in the positions of the stars as a permanent architectural signature of the 11th millennium BC.